Hi, I'm Michelle Shepard, host of Uncover Sharmini from CBC Podcasts. In 1999, 15-year-old Sharmini Anandaville disappeared on her way to a job that police believed didn't exist. 4 months later, her remains were found in a wooded ravine. I revisit the case that has stayed with me for over 20 years, ever since I first covered it as a cub crime reporter for the Toronto Star. You can find Uncover Sharmini on CBC Listen or on your favorite podcast app.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
emergency exit. Haiti's prime minister yields to mounting pressure and agrees to resign. Canada's UN representative Bob Rae says that is just the first step to ending the violence.
Paper Trial, a company that owns nearly two dozen newspapers in Atlantic Canada, files for creditor protection. And one local journalist tells us that's just the latest blow to an industry that's already on the ropes.
Wounds of war. 10 years after the end of Canada's mission in Afghanistan, the military ombudsman says it is time civilian advisors Canadian soldiers relied on are compensated for the injuries they suffered as a result.
Look Who's Not Talking, a film that's more than 100 years old featuring a superstar of the silent movie era, was thought to be lost forever before it was discovered for sale in an Omaha parking lot.
The icing on the quakes. Scientists are not shaken after detecting a flurry of mini earthquakes on the seafloor near Vancouver Island, but they are stirred because it means they'll probably get a chance to study the underwater eruption that follows.
And the qualms before the storm. Every night, a British town sees murmurations of starlings, which, one, are beautiful, but two, leave a terrible mess. And there's so much number two, they no longer care about number one. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that hopes for a quick end to this reign of terror. For a week, Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry has been stuck outside Haiti. And now we know that when he gets back inside the country, he won't be the prime minister anymore. Last night, Mr. Henry announced his resignation and said he and his government would step down once a new presidential transitional council is sworn in.
The government I'm leading is not going to be insensible to this situation. As I always say, there is no sacrifice that is too great.
In a recorded video, Mr. Henry says, "The government that I lead cannot remain indifferent to this situation. As I have always said, no sacrifice is too great for our common homeland, Haiti." His resignation follows weeks of gang violence in Port-au-Prince and meetings between the Caribbean community and North American and European officials. Among those at those meetings was Bob Rae, Canada's permanent representative to the United Nations. We reached him in New York.
Ambassador Rae, when might this transitional council be in place?
Well, very quickly. It's just a question of how quickly the Haitian political parties themselves can come together and get moving on the structure.
Or are we talking weeks, months?
No, days. We don't have weeks.
They certainly don't. So days, you're saying. This will be a 7-member presidential council. It will choose a new interim prime minister to replace Ariel Henry. How will these members be chosen?
They'll be chosen by the parties themselves or the bodies. I mean, there's one representative for an interfaith group, another representing a broad range of civil society groups. But they'll have to come together quickly and decide. The job of this council is to carry out a transition towards an election. But in order to get to an election, we have to get the level of violence way down. But I think the consensus that was reached was that there needs to be this non-partisan or multi-partisan group that's ready to set their differences aside and get moving. But there are other key issues around security, getting the multinational force going, getting more assistance on the ground, making sure we get the airport open and the ports open. So it's a pretty critical moment.
It is a crisis that has been building and building. Certainly it did not pop up overnight. A few things that I want to dissect a little bit more. First of all, Ariel Henry, the Haitians have been wanting him to step aside for a long time. What did it take to finally make it happen now?
Well, I think Mr. Henry's feeling was that he could if he was satisfied that the structure was going to be set up, and I think he realized that not only the pressure from within Haiti, but just generally just feeling, I think, that it was time. He'd been there for three years, had not really been able to get the violence under control, although we have been helping with the Haitian police force. And I think he was ready to do the right thing.
Maybe he didn't have a choice. He can't get back into the country.
Well, that's not clear. It's not that he can't get back into the country. It's that the airport isn't open. This was the ultimate.
Well, his life would be threatened, you know, based on experts we've spoken to. But in terms of the danger and the violence on the ground that has only been escalating, how realistic is it to think, or what will the mechanism be to get these gangs to go home and abandon their weapons after being able to accumulate so much power?
Well, I think there's two things that will help to make it happen. I think that once people become convinced that, you know, this is a Haitian-led change that's been encouraged by constructive partners in the region, that there really is no benefit to anybody to continue this except for the financial benefit for the gang leaders, many of whom are connected to political leaders. And the second is that a multinational force is being trained up, mm-hmm. and will come, and that will make a difference in helping the Haitian National Police to bring the gangs under control.
On the issue of the multinational force, there's been a lot of resistance across the board in Haiti for any foreign boots on the ground. Why was that important to you and the others to make that a condition of this council, knowing there's been so much opposition? And I'm not talking about gang leaders being opposed to it. I'm talking about members of civil society, Haitians at large.
Well, I mean, I think that the big issue is security in Haiti. And my impression from, I've been going there now for the last 4 years, mm-hmm. and my sense is that the Haitian people, in fact, and I've got data to back this up, actually there's quite a substantial majority of people who want assistance to the HNP. And privately, some of the people that even you talk to, who say they're against any other intervention, say, without the intervention, we can't stop the gangs. So I think it's fair to say that it's a question of what kind of intervention, mm-hmm. and really trying to build up the capacity of the Haitian people and the Haitian government itself to deal with the problem.
A lot of what we're talking about today, this transitional council and what it intends to do, does sound a lot like the Montana Accord, which we've discussed on this program with someone who helped put that accord together, this idea of a transitional government, a plan proposed by a group of Haitians. As we think about how long it's taken, how much damage and violence has been done to this point, and given what you know today, Ambassador, do you believe Canada and other countries like the United States should have supported Ariel Henry as prime minister after the assassination of Jovenel Moïse in the way that they did?
I think it's important for us to have stated out from the very beginning, and both Ambassador Carrière and Ambassador Giroux were very clear and have been very clear that we don't have a favored candidate. I was in the room when the prime minister talked very candidly to Mr. Henry about how he needed to broaden his coalition, how he needed to bring new people in. We tried to encourage that to happen. I made many visits myself. Others have made many visits to try to move this along. Is it frustrating because it's taken so long? Of course it is. But it's not just a matter of snapping your fingers. Mm-hmm. The fact is there are lots of competing elements in Haitian society that want different things. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that Canada has been very clear about is it's not up to us to support one faction or group or another. And Montana is not the only political grouping one has to deal with in Haiti. And it's taken us time to get to this place, but here we are. And I think the point is we've been doing everything we can to be positive and constructive partners to the people of Haiti in the struggle that they're going through.
Ambassador Ray, I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. It's good to talk to you.
Likewise.
Bob Ray is Canada's permanent representative to the United Nations. He's in New York. And later in the program, you'll hear Mr. Ray's response to last night's interview with Palestinian-Canadian Dr. Izzeldine Aboulaish. Canada's military ombudsman says it's time to compensate Canadians who served alongside soldiers in the country's longest ever war. They worked as language and cultural advisors during Canada's military mission in Afghanistan and suffered injuries as a result. And the ombudsman, Gregory Lick, says many haven't received the compensation they deserve. So on Friday, as the country prepared to mark the 10th anniversary of the end of the Afghan mission, Mr. Lick sent a letter to the Minister of Defense. We reached National Defense and Canadian Armed Forces Ombudsman Gregory Lick in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
Gregory Lick, what kinds of dangers, what kinds of risks were these civilian advisors facing in service of Canada?
I think one of the things to understand is that they were, before they went over, they didn't quite understand that they were really going to be outside of the wire, helping and sort of serving right alongside our troops, experiencing many of the same dangers, IEDs and that so on. So they were very much, sort of receiving the same sort of experiences as our troops did.
What were they thinking they were going to be facing and doing there? And we should mention these are Canadians of Afghan heritage who went there to assist Canadian forces. But what did they think they were going to be doing?
It's a bit strange because I think what they thought before they went over was, as far as we understand, that they would be working within the compound, providing the services of translation and some of the cultural advice to understand Afghanistan. But in actual fact, almost as soon as they got there, they were serving right outside the wire with our troops, providing the same services in a sense, but working in very dangerous conditions.
So more than 65 of these folks served in Afghanistan. How many of them have had their claims rejected?
As far as we know, the ones that have gone to the work at WSIB in Ontario, we've seen almost half of them have not received any response just yet, and about at least two have been denied.
And what kinds of injuries have they sustained?
I think we don't get insight into their injuries per se, but generally the individuals that are coming to us are facing more than just physical injuries. They're facing the more difficult ones to understand from a medical point of view, mental health issues, PTSD, and so on. Those are injuries that where they haven't really been able, in some cases, to work since Afghanistan.
Our colleague in Ottawa, Murray Brewster, has done a lot of work on this story, first reported on it back in 2019, so nearly 5 years later now. His most recent reporting this week, he quotes a Ministry of Defense spokesperson who says these advisors, quote, deserve access to the mental supports they need, and the minister's team has worked with the department on engaging the WSIB on this issue so that these claims are approved, unquote. So what's the holdup?
Well, I think from what we've seen coming back from the WSIB, they're. I always say that they're very good in understanding workplace injuries like falling off a ladder, but understanding what happens on a battlefield, which is not a normal workplace for citizens of Canada, that's very difficult for them to understand, and they probably are not well calibrated to understand that. And that's why we are pushing for the minister to use his authorities, which he has done in the past, to help in supporting them with their different injuries.
You're suggesting there's precedent for this. So what is that? What is that example, and how do you think this is similar to that?
Yes, absolutely. We helped, my predecessor helped a number of cadets and individuals who are now adults who were hurt in the 1974 grenade incident at Valcartier, Quebec. They came to us. We investigated. We saw that they were hurt. We saw that they did not receive fair treatment compared to their regular force colleagues that were instructing them at the time. The minister at the time used their authorities to help them with both income support as well as health care plans and so on. And that's what our LCAs, or language and cultural advisors, need today.
Is it bureaucracy at the end of the day?
I don't really think it's bureaucracy. I think it's just that the WSIB, there's a gap. There's a gap when civilians who served in this case, in war zones, compared to the Canadian Armed Forces, just there's a gap in their care. If they get hurt, they may not be able to get the care they receive when they get home, similar to the colleagues or troops that they may have served with. For us, it's a gap. And that needs to be fixed long term. What we care about today is the individuals who served in Afghanistan.
How does that sit with you? I know you characterize it as a gap, but these are very real issues every day for people who put their lives in danger, as you've stated, right alongside Canadian soldiers.
Yes, and most people will understand first responders who may get hurt in similar things, not so much in the battlefield. But this is an area. This is a moral question that we have a moral obligation to help these individuals that served alongside our troops, helping them. And I've talked to a number of the people that served with them. They were absolutely valuable in helping our troops in Afghanistan. They wouldn't have been the same if they had not been there.
We are marking, Canada is, the 10th anniversary of the end of its Afghan mission. The gap that you mentioned has existed for many, many years. What is it going to take to close that gap once and for all?
Well, I mean, for me, what I care about today is we get the help that these people need today. But long term, they need to work out, because there may be another war in the future, and we may need individuals like this to help our troops in understanding culture and languages and so on. We need to fix that gap. And there's a variety of ways that could be done, but I'll leave that to the department to figure that out longer term. But we are also pushing the department to work on that as well.
Gregory Lick, thank you for your time.
My pleasure, Neil.
Gregory Lick is the National Defense and Canadian Armed Forces Ombudsman. We reached him in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. You know how sometimes you have to buy a whole package of something when you just want one item? That's what happened to a man who was at an old film auction in Omaha. He recognized one cartoon on a 4-foot stack of film cans, but he was told that if he wanted it, he'd have to buy the entire palette. So he did, which probably irritated him, until he started going through the pile and realized that one of the movies was from 1923 and featured Clara Bow, one of the most famous actresses of the American silent film era. David Sten is a screenwriter and producer who wrote a biography of Ms. Bow in 1988. He has confirmed that the movie is not a fake, and he identified the film's title, The Pill Pounder. We reached Mr. Sten in Grand Cayman.
David, I'm sure you've received more than one phone call in your time from someone saying that they found a lost film. So were you skeptical when you heard the words Clara Bow and Omaha parking lot?
Sadly, I've learned to be skeptical. Yeah. Because people, as you say, with all the best intentions, reach out to me and tell me they've found a lost film, not even necessarily a lost Clara Bow film. And they may just simply be mistaken, or they may want attention, but invariably it doesn't happen. In this case, it happened.
So how did you go from skepticism to we've got something here?
I asked for a frame grab, which is just an enlargement of a single frame that would prove that the content was actually what it was purported to be. Because, as I said before, it can be accidental. Someone can see a can marked, in this case, the Pill Pounder with Clara Bow, and there is a reel of film in it, but the reel of film is different than what the label is. Mm. That's happened to me before, and it's a crushing disappointment. And when this frame grab arrived in my email, I've never seen the Pill Pounder. No one living on this planet has, but I recognized Clara Bow at 17 immediately.
And what was that moment like? What did you say as you stared at your screen?
You can't believe it. Because, especially in this case, because this was a two-reel comedy short that was made in Queens, New York when she was a teenager. It would have been shot in a week. She maybe worked 2 or 3 days. She had forgotten about this film later in life. It was that brief a moment for her. So to find something that I never expected to find, there are other lost films of hers, which I maintain hope because there's better reason to. Mm-hmm. In this case, there was no reason to. For this title of all titles to resurface, I don't use the word miracle freely, but in this case, it's completely applicable.
So that image that you mentioned, you said we saw a young Clara Bow in it. Can you describe it a little bit more for our listeners? What was in that frame?
It was a frame of a 17-year-old girl, and she was holding a phone, and she had a very expressive quality to her, which Clara Bow was known for. And of course, in silent film, when you were using your facial expressions and your body gestures to express emotion before you could use words, that was an extremely important skill set. And Clara Bow was known more than anyone else, and one of the reasons for her unprecedented popularity was the fact that she could convey emotions without words.
You are very close to Clara Bow and her story and her career. Hers is not a household name, unfortunately, right now, as it was back when she was a star. But she defined what it means to be an It Girl, very literally.
Yes, she was the first It Girl, the original It Girl. And It today means something entirely different from what it meant in her era. It today is a passing phase. It's the of the moment. In her era, when the term It Girl was coined specifically for her, it meant someone who had something so unique, a quality that attracted both sexes, that there was no way to call it anything but it. And it was partially sex appeal, but it was much more than that, because women were as big fans of Clara Bow as men were.
And she represented the autonomy of women in a way that hadn't been represented on screen before.
Yes, Clara Bow introduced the idea, she personified the idea that a woman could go out into the world, get a job, pay her own rent. She flipped the rules of courtship. It used to be that women were told, you have to wait for a man to pursue you, and then you marry him, and then you make a home for him, and you bear children and raise them for him. And Clara Bow, both on the screen and off the screen, said, no, that's not what I want to do right now. I want a career. I don't need a man. And when I want a man, I pick what man I want, and I go after that man, and I don't change for that man. That man changes for me.
What is the film about, The Pill Pounder?
Well, The Pill Pounder was a slang term in that era for a pharmacist. So it is about a pharmacist who gets in a lot of trouble with his wife and daughter and son-in-law and business. And it's a slapstick comedy.
Have you watched the whole thing?
Because it's two reels, There's not a ton of plot.
Right.
We haven't found the entire film. The film was this one reel. It was originally two reels, and it was abridged because in the late 1950s, they would show these films. They would sell them for home entertainment on a single reel. But because there were thousands of other cans of film in this auction, we are going to go through every one and find the cut, trimmed footage out of it. We'll get it back. I believe that now. If this lightning can strike twice in this case, I really believe that.
David, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
David Sten is a writer and producer who has confirmed the authenticity of a recently rediscovered 1923 film called The Pill Pounder, starring Clara Bow. We reached him in Grand Cayman. Sound of one of the most breathtaking phenomena in nature, a murmuration of starlings. When starlings gather in enormous numbers around dusk and take to the sky in a heavenly aerial ballet. What you're hearing right now is the literal sound of their wings as they swoop and dive in unison. But in 2018, Canadian composer Jordan Powell wrote a triple concerto called Starling that attempted to create the feeling of a murmuration through music. Beautiful and evocative. You can almost see the starlings. But the good people of Great Gonerby, Lincolnshire, England, have a note for the composer. His piece is missing some percussion. With apologies to Mr. Powell, the Thunder Bay Symphony, and the Griffin Trio there, it's time for those of us who have watched from a distance, marveling at the astonishing amount of beauty in the world, to realize that the people under a murmuration are marveling at the astonishing amount of starling feces in the world, and on their houses, and sidewalks, and cars, and doorknobs, and heads. Every night at sunset for weeks now, there has been a murmuration above Great Gonerby. Now, at first, the locals loved it. Now, everyone except the people who run the local car wash wants it to end. Jonathan Brown has been putting a tarp over his car every evening before the starlings get going. They're a thick black cloud, he told the BBC, and you can hear them. And you can hear the showers of poo coming down. Everyone quoted says the murmurations are beautiful. It's just that the aftermath is disgusting. It's tough to deal with, but the people of that town are scraping by and scraping off.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
No news is good news, of course, but the possibility of less news is bad news. Saltwire Network owns nearly 24 newspapers in Atlantic Canada. It has just filed for creditor protection and revealed that it's in debt, $94 million worth of debt. The company, which owns the Halifax Chronicle Herald, the Telegram in St. John's, and the Guardian in Charlottetown, put a brave face on the financial revelations, saying the court process will, quote, enable us to emerge as a stronger, more vibrant media company, unquote, but at the moment it is not clear how. Tim Bousquet is the founder of the independent media outlet, the Halifax Examiner. We reached him in Halifax.
Tim, as we've said, you're not affiliated with Saltwire, but as you heard this news and heard what's happened, how does it feel to be a journalist in Atlantic Canada?
Oh, it's just another gut punch to the entire profession and to my colleagues here in Atlantic Canada and Halifax, Nova Scotia. Just what else could happen?
What are Saltwire journalists telling you today?
Well, they're all brokenhearted. It's been one thing after another for them. Many of them were at other publications and ended up at Saltwire or had been laid off and called back to Saltwire. There was a strike some years ago that some of them had gone through. They were completely in the dark about the financial situation of Saltwire. They were relying on my reporting to inform themselves about what was going on these past few months. You know, they're stunned. It's a huge life blow to them. It's not good.
And the size of Saltwire's debt, I think huge is an appropriate term to use, $94 million. What did you make of that number when you saw it?
Well, a lot of that is just typical operating debt, but the debt to their lender of $37 million and their CRA debt of $7 million, their money they owed into the pension plan, it looks like since the creation of Saltwire, they haven't paid anything other than their normal operating costs. So they haven't paid back any of the principal on their loan or even most of the interest on it. They haven't paid their HST payments. They haven't paid into the pension plan. I don't know what kind of business strategy that was.
So is this then, you know, another case of a blow to the media, to the industry, as has been happening, as you've said, or is this a case of financial mismanagement?
Well, I think it's both. Saltwire made some horrendous decisions even before Saltwire was created. Its predecessor, the Halifax Herald, spent a lot of money on a brand new printing press that they should have seen where the industry was going and held off on that purchase. But since then, they've made a lot of kind of dumb decisions, starting a ill-fated magazine, some other things they did. But that said, you know, I don't think the best business manager in the world could run a profitable newspaper business in Atlantic Canada.
Why not?
Well, just the fundamentals aren't there. The ad-supported news media business has collapsed. It's, there's no business case for it anywhere outside of maybe New York City and some of the prestige papers like the New York Times and The Guardian. Outside of that, just advertising supported media just doesn't work.
You founded the Halifax Examiner. You've shown that you can operate it independently. How are you doing it?
That's right. And when I started the Examiner almost exactly 10 years ago, I made the conscious decision not to accept advertising because I saw where that revenue source was going, which was south. It was more trouble to chase advertising than the revenue it would bring in. I think that was the right decision. We rely entirely on, or almost entirely on, reader subscriptions.
And you've got the readers.
Yeah. As I say, we've been around 10 years. We have grown. We're doing important journalism. We're just small. We don't have the hundreds of reporters that SaltWire has had. We have maybe six. And we don't have the resources to do that reporting out in small towns and in the provinces, provincially on resource issues and such. But we can't do that, you know, small town council reporting or what's happening in Colchester County or what have you.
Could this development mean good news for you, or do you see it differently? Good news in the sense that it will bring more eyeballs to you.
Yeah, you know, I think it will. Every time something terrible happens to the Herald, we see a bunch of bump in subscriptions. I don't like that. Of course, I'll take it and I'll try to use the resources as best we can. And in a previous Herald strike, I was able to hire one of their reporters. We've done stuff like that. But the benefit it brings to the Halifax Examiner is does not compare to the huge loss that the province is experiencing here.
What is that loss? Just illustrate it for people who maybe, you know, aren't as invested in this industry as you are. What does a province and the people of that province lose, in your view, when you lose more journalistic outlets?
Well, when SaltWire was created in 2017, they bought 28 newspapers in Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, and Prince Edward Island. The bulk of those were in Nova Scotia. So these small papers, which were able to cover their local town council, which were able to tell the business news in small communities, you know, profile people in those communities, build sense of communities in rural areas, you know, that's gone now. Or will soon be gone. And it's been diminishing for a long time. So those communities in particular, it's like losing the school or losing the post office or the corner store in your community. It's just part of the degradation of the community that ultimately leads to it being abandoned completely. Worse than that even is I think the main news source for people in those communities now is, you know, your crazy Uncle John on Facebook or you know, people who are able to spew nonsense and not paid professional reporters. And that's just tragic for democracy.
SaltWire, in its own press release, seems to be suggesting it can continue operating at least some of its papers. Do you think that that's realistic?
I mean, we'll see as over the next week or so. There's a court hearing tomorrow, and SaltWire's asked for an extension for a week, which they'll probably get before all these issues have played out. But the lender, the private equity fund that
Fiera
initiated this, Fiera wants liquidation. They want the assets sold off. It's hard to see how that doesn't happen, but I will leave it to greater legal minds than mine. But they are owed all this money. They own the mortgages on the properties. They have first dibs on all liabilities. So it's hard to see how a court won't go along with that, but we'll see.
And we'll see what you and your team report on as the developments keep coming. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, it's good to talk with you.
Likewise.
Take care.
Tim Bousquet is the founder of the independent media outlet, the Halifax Examiner. We reached him in Halifax. If you were listening to yesterday's show, you may have heard Neil's conversation with Izzeldin Aboulaish, a Palestinian-Canadian physician who lost three daughters and a niece to an Israeli attack in 2009 and has lost more than 20 members of his extended family since October 7th. So, as you may have heard, he remains committed to nonviolence, even in the face of all that loss, but that doesn't mean he's not angry. And as he told us last night, some of his anger is directed at Canada.
This is part of the longer tradition of Canada engaging constructively and positively in the world. But what are they doing? Even the world condemnation, the word condemnation, I never heard it from the prime minister or any official. Always they are saying, we are concerned, we are sorry about what is happening. You see it, even the government of Canada, they wanted to sponsor 1,000 Palestinians. Until now, I submitted to bring any of my relatives to save them. Until now, it's only just words.
Palestinian-Canadian physician Izzeldin Aboulaish with a message for Canadian politicians following 5 months of war. Earlier on tonight's show, Neil spoke with Canada's ambassador to the UN, Bob Rae. And before we let him go, she asked him one more question, how he responded to the doctor's criticisms.
I think Canada has been as clear as could be. I feel I have been, and if I'm happy to talk to the doctor, I'm happy to talk to anybody about this. We want a ceasefire. We have urged Israel to agree to a ceasefire. We've urged the release of the hostages and the prisoner exchanges and getting the war over. I think the thing that everyone has to understand is that the destruction that's taken place in Gaza is unprecedented. And I think, like many other people, I share the view that we have to bring this war to an end, and the violence has to stop. I know that Minister Joly has been in Israel and in the West Bank the last 2 days. I know when she comes back, she'll be glad to talk to you about her trip.
I hope so. Yeah.
And I think it's very important that we stay on this course. We are working hard for a two-state solution. We firmly believe that the Palestinian people have a right to self-government, and we think that their people, everyone, has a right to live in peace. And I also have to say, I think Hamas has done and is doing terrible things. And it's difficult sometimes for the people who are living in Gaza to say that, but I know they feel that way. And we have to deal with that problem, and that's something that has to be part of the solution as well.
Canada's UN Ambassador Bob Rae. Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly concludes a visit to Israel and the West Bank tomorrow. U.S. President Joe Biden is one of the most powerful men in the world, and Robert Herr says his conduct has posed serious risks to national security. That was the finding in a report the former special counsel released earlier this year on Mr. Biden's mishandling of classified documents. Mr. Herr failed to recommend criminal charges, but used language his critics alleged was inflammatory. Today, Robert Herr defended his report in front of Congress.
My task was to determine whether the president retained or disclosed national defense information willfully. That means knowingly and with the intent to do something the law forbids. I could not make that determination without assessing the president's state of mind. For that reason, I had to consider the president's memory and overall mental state and how a jury likely would perceive his memory and mental state in a criminal trial. These are the types of issues that prosecutors analyze every day. My assessment in the report about the relevance of the president's memory was necessary and accurate and fair. Most importantly, what I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly. I explained to the Attorney General my decision and the reasons for it. That's what I was required to do.
Former Special Counsel Robert Hur testifying in Congress today about his investigation into President Biden's handling of classified documents. He responded to multiple attacks by Democrats who accused him of using political rhetoric. Here's his exchange with California lawmaker Adam Schiff.
What you are suggesting is that I needed to provide a different version of my report that would be fit for public release. That is nowhere in the rules. I was to prepare a confidential report that was comprehensive and thorough of an
explanation. What is in the rules, Mr. Hur, what is in the rules is you don't gratuitously do things to prejudice the subject of an investigation when you're declining to prosecute. You don't gratuitously add language that you know will be useful in a political campaign. You were not born yesterday. You understood exactly what you were doing. It was a choice. You certainly didn't have to include that language. You could have said, vis-a-vis the documents that were found at the university, the president did not recall. There is nothing more common. You know this. I know this. There is nothing more common with a witness of any age when asked about events that are years old to say, I do not recall. Indeed, they're instructed by their attorney to do that if they have any question about it. You understood that. You made a choice. That was a political choice. It was the wrong choice. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Did Special Counsel wish to respond to that final question?
Yes, Congressman. What you are suggesting is that I shape, sanitize, omit portions of my reasoning and explanation to the Attorney General for political reasons.
No, I suggest that you not shape your report for political reasons, which is what you did.
That did not happen, Congressman. That did not happen.
U.S. Special Counsel Robert Hur and Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff speaking today at the House Judiciary Committee. There have been rumblings around Vancouver Island. I don't mean gossip, I mean actual rumblings. 200 mini earthquakes per hour observed by scientists last Wednesday, about 300 kilometers off the coast. That increase in activity has the scientists predicting an eruption of magma, one that will give them a chance to learn more about how the Earth's crust expands. Kate Moran is the president and CEO of Ocean Networks Canada, the organization tracking the data. We reached her in Victoria, BC.
Kate, if it happens, what is this eruption going to be like?
Well, it will be an eruption where it brings magma up to the seafloor and creates ocean crust, new ocean crust. That's what we call the new basis or the basement of the ocean floor. And it's continuously being generated along these ridge systems, but it's intermittent in various locations. So we anticipate that's what's going to happen.
You have a baseball analogy to get our minds around it?
Yes, I think if everyone could just close their eyes and think about the planet, take all the ocean water out, and you're looking at the seafloor, and these ridges, like the Endeavour segment of the Juan de Fuca Ridge, really, they go all around the globe, and you think of it, you could imagine the actual threads on a baseball. And that's what it really looks like if you take all the water out. So they're covering all of the oceans, and it's where new ocean crust is formed, and continental plates, the tectonic plates, are separating from each other.
You're able to predict this eruption because of the mini earthquakes we mentioned in our introduction that you and the team detected last week on Wednesday, I believe. You were using recording devices. We're going to play just a few seconds of what you heard, and then I'll talk to you about it. So to our ears, that almost sounds, Kate, like a lot like dead air, something that would make us excited in a bad way. But when you heard that, it made you excited in a good way. Why?
Well, we actually were recording and hearing the actual earthquake as it was happening at the Endeavour segment of the Juan de Fuca Ridge, which is just remarkable because it's over 200 kilometers offshore in 2 kilometers of water, and here we were hearing in near real time an earthquake happening.
What makes you so sure that the eruption we talked about at the outset of our chat is actually going to happen?
Well, it happened 20 years ago, and we know that after the fact, Ocean Networks Canada actually monitors this location in real time with sensor systems connected to cables that bring the data in real time to the internet. 20 years ago, this happened, but it was only understood after the fact. And so now we're actually scientists actually started looking, about 4 or 5 years ago, saying there's some increased activity, a little bit above the normal earthquake activity happening at this location. We should anticipate something happening in the next few years. And a big one just started. February, there was increased activity. And then last week, March 6th, big time activity.
Next few years. So how do you prepare and continue your work to lead up to that?
Well, we have to make sure the sensors are always functioning. And so we go out to sea every year to replace sensors, clean them, ensuring they're working and functioning. Because unlike 20 years ago, now we can actually record this in real time and understand how new ocean crust is formed. So it really is quite an exciting time for us. But we'll go out again in June at sea. We'll take robots because it's deep water. We'll go down and look at the location to see if there's any changes from last year, which we think there will be based on what we heard in that recording. And then we'll ensure that all those sensor systems are functioning again so that as activity continues to increase, which we anticipate it will, we'll get data in real time.
You know, I grew up in Vancouver, and of course there were earthquake drills and discussions about the big one always. Does work like this underwater help inform that question and that preparation?
In terms of the big one, as we call it here in British Earth, these are earthquakes that are quite far from what's called the subduction zone. They're almost at the other end of the spectrum. So it will inform our understanding of how new ocean crust is formed. And, of course, ultimately that ocean crust does subduct under the North American plate, which is when we say subduction, that means the big one. But that's this new ocean crust, it'll be millions of years before it gets to that stage. So it's really understanding the other end of the spectrum of the tectonic plate from subduction. So it's a very interesting science discovery. We don't normally have these kind of real-time data and a multitude of sensors to help us understand how new ocean crust is formed. So this is very exciting for the science community.
And for those who are not scientists but also excited and will be, watching the water closely, what will they actually see?
Well, when you can follow us and when we go out at sea in June, we live stream all the video of looking at this location, and it is one of the most dynamic locations offshore Canada. It is at what's Canada's first marine protected area called the Endeavour segment of the Wandafuca Ridge, and it is exciting even before this happened because what we see there is 300 degree seawater, rich in minerals, spewing out of the seafloor all the time, forming these giant black smokers. So we'll be going there and seeing if that kind of smoker system has changed and seeing if there's other kinds of perhaps magma events coming out of the seafloor. So you'll be able to see it with your own eyes in real time when we go out to sea later at the end of June.
Well, perhaps we'll speak again in the summer then, Kate. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your interest.
Kate Moran is the president and CEO of Ocean Networks Canada. We reached her in Victoria, BC. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.